once again, it is I, Brad Friedman, happy to spend the next 3 hours with you truth seekers out there from coast to coast and around the globe here on the Mike Malloy program, sitting in one last day for Mike. He will be back along with Kathy on Monday in fine fettle, and I have a feeling he'll be in a fighting mood for a change. So you can look forward to that, and if you can put up for me with just a few more hours, I'd be delighted. I'll try to make it worth your while. We've got a big show coming up tonight. It is, as you know, the eighth anniversary of 9/11, when 2,998 folks were killed in an attack in New York City, in Washington, D.C., and somewhere in a field in Pennsylvania. Since then, 5,167 U.S. troops have been killed in response in Iraq and Afghanistan. So we lost just under 3,000 on September 11th, and we've lost a couple hundred over 5,000 since then. Of course, those numbers, as I wrote today, do not reflect those folks who were injured in the events mentioned, nor the uncountable lives lost of those who responded following the 9/11 disaster. Doesn't count the private contractors killed abroad in our multiple wars, our multiple continuing wars, nor the journalists who covered them, nor the hundreds of thousands of non-U.S. citizens in foreign countries who similarly became victims in the horrific events of the months and years which followed that fateful day. I vowed at the Brad blog today that we will remember them not just today, but every day, and in their memories, I vow, never to live in fear. So tonight we will be fearless. We will, to quote Glenn Beck quoting Tom Jefferson, we will question with boldness as we talk about 9/11 from a bunch of different angles. Get your thoughts on it. You can give us a call tonight at 877-520-1150. That's 877-520-1150. Don't use Mike Malloy's normal number. Use that one, 877-520-1150. We'd love to hear from you. I'm going to have John Farmer with us very momentarily. John Farmer was the senior counsel, one of the senior counsels to the 9/11 Commission. He's got a new book out in which he says, well, everything that, not everything, but a great deal of what the government and military officials told Congress and the 9/11 Commission and the media and the public was almost entirely and inexplicably untrue. Really? That's a senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission. So we are going to be asking him many questions about that. If you'd like to ask a question to a senior counsel on the 9/11 Commission, well, now is your opportunity. Also going to take the opportunity to ask him some questions that are apparently not allowed to be asked, at least if you want to serve in the Barack Obama administration. Some questions that were on a 9/11 truth statement that was signed by 50 family members and that Glenn Beck apparently found quite objectionable. So we're going to try to ask him about some of those questions as well, because I think this country needs to have discussion. I think questions need to be asked. I think we need to investigate and follow those investigations wherever they may lead. I'll be probably giving you some of my own feelings tonight about 9/11 and about the conspiracy theories surrounding it, and I don't say that with any disdain. I'll try to talk about where I stand on that, and we'll try to get some real answers for a change from the senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission and from folks out there from a lot of different angles. So let me get straight to Mr. Farmer here. John Farmer joins us. He is, as I said, the senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission. Oh, before I do that, Bradblog.com has our chat room open tonight. Agent 99 will be manning that, hosting that, hostessing that all night. So if you'd like to stop by over there and take part in the rather lively discussion try to get my attention with some questions there, I'll do my best to keep an eye on that chat room. All right. Back to business here. John Farmer is a senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission. He served as the Attorney General of New Jersey, chief counsel to Governor Christine Todd Whitman. He's now the dean of Rutgers University Law School, and he joins us here tonight very happily so. He is the author of the new book, The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. John Farmer, welcome to the Mike Malloy Program.
Well, thanks, Brad. Appreciate it.
Really,
thanks for having me.
Sure. Really glad to have you here, particularly on today of all days. All right. In your book and in the publicity for the book, you note that what government and military officials told Congress, the 9/11 Commission on which you served, the media and the public, was, quote, almost entirely and inexplicably untrue. That's some pretty heady allegations there. And before we find out what was inexplicably untrue, it occurs to me, with a claim like that from a senior counsel on the 9/11 Commission, you must be barraged with media requests. 60 Minutes, CNN, Fox News, MSNBC. Is that true? Are the media paying attention to such an extraordinary claim as you're making here?
It's been a busy week, let me put it that way.
has it been as much as you would have expected?
Yeah.
Good.
I think I've done probably 30 plus interviews this week, so
good.
There has been interest in the book, and I hope the book makes a contribution to settling a lot of the speculation that's occurred out there.
Fair enough. All right, so let's jump into some of the key points, and you detail some of them. I know you've got what you describe as whiskey tango foxtrot moments, in other words, known as WTF moments. I think a lot of people listening will understand what that means. But what are the key points here which you found in your investigation, really after the 9/11 Commission put out its report, that what was almost entirely and inexplicably untrue?
Well, I should point out that my function with the 9/11 Commission was to lead a team to put together an account of the nation's reaction to the attacks. In other words, reconstruct the events of the day of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And there are obviously many components to that, from what the president was doing, the vice president, to what the Pentagon was doing, to what the firefighters and police in New York were doing, to what was happening virtually all over the country. So very daunting task when you had basically a year and a half to put it together. So going into it, I really thought that the air defense side of that story would be the easiest part to put together, simply because the story had been told so many times in so many different forums. There had been testimony before Congress. There had been major network news specials dedicated strictly to the air defense story. There had even been an early commission hearing dedicated to that subject. So the story was out there, and it had been told numerous times. So I actually started writing an account of the day of, based strictly on the public sources, figuring that, well, we'll get hold of the primary sources, and we can simply validate what's already been told.
Mm-hmm.
But to my disappointment, to put it mildly, when we started getting access to the primary sources, which ultimately took a subpoena to the FAA and to the Department of Defense, we couldn't verify the public account that had been given. And to summarize what that account was, it basically overstated the efficacy and the efficiency of the government's response. And specifically, what we had been told after 9/11 was that by the time of the third flight, American 77, which ultimately hit the Pentagon, the national command structure had recovered from the shock of the two flights that hit the World Trade Center and had reestablished itself, essentially, and had scrambled planes from Langley Air Force Base to protect the Capitol. And those planes narrowly missed intercepting American 77, but were certainly in position by the time of United 93 hijacking. And when that turned toward Washington, they were certainly in position that they could have taken the plane out if they had to as it approached Washington. And what we found happened, in fact, when we went through the records and through the tapes and the different logs that were kept, They told a very consistent story, which was that, in fact, the military had had basically a minute's notice that American 77 was missing with no location given, and they had had actually no notice of 93 until 4 minutes after the plane crashed, so they never were able to even locate that flight on radar. The planes were scrambled from Langley, but it was not in response to either of the last two flights. It was in response to a mistaken report that had come across the radio that the first flight, American 11, had actually not hit the Trade Center at all, but was still airborne heading south for Washington. So in other words, just to finish the story, the authorization to intercept and potentially shoot down planes came from the National Command Structure, from the President and Vice President, about 30 minutes after United 93 had already crashed. So that particular authorization was never passed to the pilots because at that point there was no target.
Interesting. So, hold the thought there, John. Yeah. I'm speaking with John Farmer, Senior Counsel to the 9/11 Commission, author of the new book, The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. We're going to take your calls at 877-520-1150. Brad Friedman of bradblog.com, in for Mike Malloy. A whole lot more right after this. Stay with us. Oh, man, the phone lines are lighting up for John Farmer, my guest, the senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission, author of The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. This book is just out, released within the last week or two, and we're going to dig in, take as many of your calls and questions as we can. I've got a lot of my own, of course, 877-520-1150, and you can participate over at the chat room at bradblog.com. All right, let me get Jen. There we go. Got Mr. Farmer back on here. John, you were speaking before the break about some of the things that you were told and the public was told, the commission was told, that were, quote, almost entirely and inexplicably untrue. You referred to the fact that the claim that they could have taken out Flight 93 if they had wanted to, that they had it within their sights and so on and so forth. Why do you suspect some of these stories would have been told that were so wildly inaccurate as you describe them?
I think there was an effort to make the government look, you know, better than it was that day, and to make the national command structure seem like it was more in control than it really was in those critical moments. And I think in doing that, one of the unfortunate byproducts was that they obscured some of the really important lessons from that morning, among which are, you know, how critical decisions are actually made in a cataclysmic situation like that, and the essential estrangement of the top levels from the people on the ground who actually had to improvise the national defense was important because we saw it replicated a few years later in Hurricane Katrina. A completely different kind of event, in fact, not a surprise at all, something that they had been planned for years, but when it actually hit, the same kind of dynamic occurred where people on the ground in New Orleans were waiting for word from the upper levels of government, and there was a disconnect in communications and difficulty communicating, and they didn't have the authority to make critical decisions. And I think one of the things that comes out of this study that I think is important is the imperative that we actually plan to deal with these crises the way they're actually experienced, as opposed to according to some organization chart.
Right, and we seem to have we constructed an organizational chart after 9/11 in response to 9/11, and then, as you point out in the book, it doesn't seem that we paid much attention to it when it came to Katrina. So it's unclear that we even learned anything from 9/11, frankly. And I wonder the effectiveness of the commission. You guys did not have subpoena power early on. And how badly do you think that ended up crippling the final report that was released by the 9/11 Commission?
Well, let me just say that I think the report is extremely accurate and sets forth the facts of 9/11. And actually, we did point out in the report the discrepancies between between the accounts that were given and what we actually found. But what's different is, you know, in this account is, I think, by telling it structurally differently. In other words, in the commission report, we told it flight by flight, as much for the sake of clarity as anything else, just so you could understand with each flight what happened.
Right.
That's not the way it was lived, though, by the people who had to respond, and that's what this book does. It tells the story almost from their perspective, when everything's flying at them at once. And I think the value of that is that you can see that, taken as a whole, you can see that the real enemy of preparedness is bureaucracy. And that's a tough nut to crack, but I think it's the one we have to if we're going to be better in the future.
And you've broken that all down in a timeline in the back of the book, painstaking details based on the radio transmissions and so forth that did exist, even though they originally said they didn't. We're going to talk much more about that. Take your calls. And I'm going to ask a few of Glenn Beck's questions to John Farmer, author of Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack. I'm Brad, sitting in for Mike. We're back with a whole lot more. Stick with us right after this. Welcome back to the Mike Malloy program. Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, your friendly citizen investigative journalist, blogger, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around good guy, drafted into duty here to be the media all week. This week for Mike, while they're taking a break, he will be back Monday. We're speaking with John Farmer, the senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission. He served as the Attorney General of New Jersey for a while, and he's got a new book out called The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11, in which he says that the official story given to Congress and the Commission and the media and the public was almost entirely and inexplicably untrue. We're going to take your calls in a moment. The board is lighting up at 877-520-1150. Let's see. All right, got him back. All right. I have a number of questions for you, John.
Okay.
Let me start here. Let's get right to the accountability thing. Given what the commission was told that appeared to be untrue, and one of them that you you write in your book about that you had direct access to was the NORAD's Northeast Air Defense Sector. You were told there were not tapes of radio transmissions, and in fact, there were tapes of radio transmissions, as you later learned. Given the various lies that were given for whatever reason, how can it be, in your opinion, that when George Bush and Dick Cheney were interviewed themselves about their response, about their readiness, their preparation, and anything else, that they were allowed to testify together, not recorded? Now, you're the former Attorney General of New Jersey. Can you explain to me how it is that you allow two folks involved in an investigation to be interviewed together like that?
Well, that was a decision that was reached in negotiation with the White House, a negotiation I was not personally involved with, so I can't really relate the details of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a negotiated agreement with the president and vice president, and it was, you know, detailed notes were taken. I was not part of that interview, so I can't really comment on the specifics of it. But
well, as an attorney general, how do you feel about it? You didn't take part in the negotiations, I understand, but in an investigation, how do you feel about, two people involved in that investigation would like to speak together and would not like to have any of it recorded?
Well, it really depends on the context. I mean, you know, in certain types of criminal investigations, you wouldn't want to have that happen. But I've been involved in corporate internal investigations where it's actually easier to get to the truth doing it that way, because they play one off against the other. So, you know, it really depends on the context.
And so you have no problem with that in general?
No, in general, I don't. It really depends on the individual circumstances. It could be problematic, and it might not be. And I think we did a good job of pointing out areas in which we took issue with the version of events that they recounted.
Do you think there was proper accountability brought to the folks who did drop the ball before 9/11?
Well, you know, I think, again, if you read the book as a whole, I think if there's a villain in the book, other than bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, who are, we can never forget, are the principal villains, but it's bureaucracy itself. And I don't think enough has been done to sort of reinvent government. That was the term used in the 90s. And there was a recognition that, you know, in the post-Cold War period, threats were likely to arise asymmetrically, and there was a need to reconfigure government. And there were efforts being made, but they didn't go far enough, and they were not effective. And so the answer to your question, in my view, is I think a lot more needs to be done, and it has to be at a very, very fundamental level, because you know, bureaucracy is the enemy of preparedness. And that's really, if I'm going to state one conclusion from the book, that's what it is.
So it was, as you see it, it was bureaucracy, incompetence, perhaps, not necessarily malfeasance or misfeasance by these folks?
Well, you know, if you had, for example, if you had one agency that was you know, really responsible for the whole thing and it totally screwed up and you know, I could see then wanting to, you know, to have the let the heads roll kind of mentality. But when you see, as I detail in the book, in agency after agency, department head after department head, of varying degrees of abilities and across departments, across crises, because you had the same thing in Katrina, different departments, and you realize that they all have one thing in common, and that is an inability to cope with this creature that we come to call bureaucracy. And when you have failures on that scale, I don't think it really benefits anybody to start scapegoating people, because I think that actually lets bureaucracy off the hook.
Well, there's a difference between scapegoating and accountability. I mean, when people are warned time and again, as we understand that the Bush administration was warned, do you feel that they, your feeling is they didn't respond to those warnings from Richard Clark and so forth simply because, oh, it's such a big bureaucracy out there?
Well, I think you have to go before that. You can go by the time President Bush took office. Remember that the Al-Qaeda conspirators had essentially run the gauntlet of our trillion-dollar early warning system. They had managed throughout the 90s to elude detection by the NSA, by the CIA, and one of the hundreds of military bases that we have stationed around the world to provide early warning. They had managed to get through customs. They had managed to get into the country.
Well, there was a lot of things.
So that by the time the summer of 2001 came along, they had basically run the gauntlet through every better funded department than FAA and NORAD. And at the end of the day, we had probably two of the least well funded organizations in the government that ended up having to fight the war that day.
But at the top of the government, one of the best funded agencies in the government, the White House, there was very clear warnings. Was there not?
Listen, there's no question about it. And look, I think the failures are so pervasive and so widespread. You know, they had after the millennium, there was an after action report done that basically pointed out that our preparations domestically for a terrorist event were very lax. And that report was out there. And in fact, it's that report that Sandy Berger, the former national security advisor to President Clinton, actually took copies of and stole from the National Archives before he was scheduled to testify before the commission, hid them in a construction site, and then destroyed them.
And was there accountability for that?
Well, he pled to a misdemeanor.
Okay. And was there accountability anywhere else in the government that you see?
Well, there was, as a consequence of our referral of the credibility story to the Inspectors General of Department of Defense and Department of Transportation, there was a Department of Transportation employee disciplined as a result of failing to be forthcoming with us.
The Department of Transportation employee?
Yeah, well, someone from the FAA, essentially.
Okay, but nobody from the actually from the Bush administration whose job it was to protect against this sort of thing?
Well, if there was, I'm not aware of it.
Yeah. Okay. And, well, now let me get to some of these questions that Glenn Beck, you may have heard, was able to railroad this guy, Van Jones, the president's green jobs advisor, out of a job because he signed onto a statement along with 50 family members of 9/11 victims asking certain questions. And he highlighted a number of those questions. And John Farmer, I'm sorry to make you the victim somewhat here of Glenn Beck, but he highlighted about four of these 12 questions that all seemed reasonable to me. And I'll note that I don't have a dog in this hunt. I just want to know what the hell happened. So I'd like to ask you the four questions that he found so outrageous, and you may or may not be able to answer them. I don't know, but I'm going to go ahead and toss them out here, John.
Okay.
The first one, I'll go through in order. Why did the Secret Service allow Bush to complete his elementary school visit apparently unconcerned about his safety or that of the school children?
Well, yeah, there's been a lot of speculation about, you know, why President Bush continued to sit in the classroom after he was advised that the nation was under attack. I think that, you know, this is just my opinion, but I think he was trying to, A, assimilate the information. It was kind of startling. And at the same time, because he knew he was being filmed, I think he was trying to project an image of calm, that he was, you know, not going to be rattled by this, and he was going to leave at an appropriate time, and he made that judgment.
And are you offended that I ask you that question?
No.
Thank you. All right, let me ask a few more that Glenn Beck highlighted that he found so unbelievable that he couldn't imagine how Van Jones would even be allowed near the president for having signed on to some of these questions. All right, how could Flight 77, which reportedly hit the Pentagon, have flown back towards Washington, D.C. for 40 minutes without being detected by the FAA's radar or even superior radar possessed by the U.S. military?
Well, it's not clear that the military possessed superior radar for as the first answer to that, but the second answer is, you know, it did appear there was an area in the country where there was a gap in radar coverage in the mountains, and so it was off radar for a while, and it did appear as a primary radar track, not a beacon signal, which would clearly have indicated which flight it was. But it was, you know, but you have to understand that in the radar picture with primary tracks, it's really an ocean of primary tracks. And unless you know exactly what you're looking for, it's hard to pick it out. And, you know, we,
for 40 minutes though, it could disappear like that.
Well, behind, you know, they were the controllers were actually, once it vanished from radar, they were, and it had been heading west. The controllers in Cleveland were actually looking west for it and couldn't find it. And ultimately, they started looking back the other way, but they simply didn't pick it up.
Okay, and you're not offended by that question, are you, John?
No, not at all.
Okay, thank you. Let me get one more here before we got to go to a break. Then we'll have some more Beck questions and your calls. And John, you're invited to stay around as long as you like tonight, because there's a lot of folks who want to ask you a lot of questions.
I have a 10 o'clock appointment.
Damn it. All right.
10 o'clock in the east, so I've got another 15 minutes, then I got to go.
Then we're going to move quick here. How were the FBI and CIA able to release the names and photos of the alleged hijackers within hours, as well as to visit houses, restaurants, and flight schools they were known to frequent?
Well, it's a complicated story, but the bureau at least, and to a lesser extent the CIA, was actually looking for several of these people in the days and weeks leading up to 9/11, and you know, hadn't located them. But when they saw the passenger manifest from the flights, it wasn't hard to figure out who was who. You know, this is one of those areas where, you know, it's when you look at it from the outside, well, how could they have been looking for them and not found them? But they didn't, and that's one of the tragedies of 9/11, and that's one of the areas in which the barriers for information sharing between the two agencies really prevented them from finding them.
I'm glad to get your answer to that on record, and once again, you're not offended by that question, right?
No.
Okay, thank you. We're going to speak more with John Farmer, senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission and author of the new book, The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. One more question that Glenn Beck found so offensive, and I'm going to try to get as many of your calls in as I can in the remaining time we have left with Mr. Farmer. You're listening to the Mike Malloy Program. Brad Friedman in for Mike, and we're going to be with you all night long. Stick with us.
station at railhead.
Welcome back to the Mike Malloy Program. Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com in for Mike on the 8th anniversary of 9/11. Mike and Kathy will be back next Monday. We're speaking with John Farmer, the author of The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. John was a senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission, and he notes that so much of what the public and the media and the commission were told was, quote, almost entirely and inexplicably untrue, and we're trying to unwind which points were inexplicably untrue. To that end, I want to get right to the phones as quickly as I can, but I got one more question from Glenn Beck, who was so offended by these questions when Van Jones signed on to a statement essentially asking for a new investigation by 50 family members or so. That last question, John, try to do it quick here. Why did the Bush administration cover up the fact that the head of the Pakistani intelligence agency was in Washington the week of 9/11 and reportedly had $100,000 wired to Mohammed Atta, considered the ringleader of the hijackers?
I don't know whether that's true. I can't comment on that. If that's, you know, I don't know.
Have you heard that allegation before?
No, I haven't.
And do you think, if it is true, is it an appropriate question to ask and to get an answer to from someone?
If it's true, absolutely.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. Jeannie Dean in the chat room says she's concerned about the NORAD failures and the contradictions in the NORAD-related testimony. I know that was your beat on the commission here. Why was it completely overlooked by the commission? She feels that the NORAD failures were overlooked when it was the most damning evidence to date that there is something that demands further investigation here. Family members requested a follow-up investigation, but what happened there?
Well, the short answer is that it wasn't the failures weren't ignored. They were actually highlighted in Chapter 1 of the report. Originally, that chapter was supposed to be Chapter 9. It was supposed to come, you know, sort of in sequence. But the commissioners decided to move it up to the front because we had discovered these discrepancies, and so they were actually highlighted in the report.
And are you satisfied, finally, with the answers to those discrepancies and why they existed, why NORAD did fail on that day?
Well, you know, I think you have to distinguish between what they actually did that day and what the government told people they did, because, what the book does at a level of detail that the commission couldn't, because the material was still classified at the time that the commission report came out, and it's since been declassified. But it lays out exactly, you know, who said what to whom and how the reaction took place. And you basically are left with a lot of empathy for these folks in NORAD who had to react on the fly to a situation that they were not really trained to react to.
Okay, let me get to Keith here in Norwalk, California. Keith, as quickly as you can ask your question, because we're gonna have to lose Mr. Farmer at the top of the hour. Keith.
No problem. As far as the Keene Zillicow cover-up that you're involved in goes, I would like to ask you, how were the FBI able to confiscate the Citgo gas station's tape so quickly, and where are those photos? I'd like to see them.
Thanks, Keith. And did you get to look at those tapes from the Pentagon, John?
Yes, we did. I know there's been a lot of speculation about whether a plane actually hit the Pentagon. I can assure you that it did. They actually were able to reconstruct large components of the plane. And actually, someone who was a member of my team, was a naval intelligence officer in the Pentagon that morning, was severely burned. And in fact, everybody in his unit was killed and had a permanent lung damage from inhaling jet fuel. He has no doubt that a plane hit the Pentagon.
But why was there no debris field, really, out there in Pennsylvania, and why have no pieces of the plane showed up from the Pentagon crash?
Well, pieces of the plane do exist in the Pentagon crash. And I would take issue with the Pennsylvania remark, too. I mean, I think the Pennsylvania situation is accounted for by the fact that the angle at which the plane hit the ground was almost directly perpendicular, and I think that accounted for how deep the crater was. And the other question to ask yourself with respect to this is, well, if American 77 didn't hit the Pentagon, what happened to American 77? And what about the passengers who were calling from the plane saying they were coming back to Washington?
Okay, and just to be clear, because we're hitting the clock here, John,
yeah.
you have seen tapes of a plane hitting the Pentagon?
I haven't seen pictures of a plane actually hitting the Pentagon, but there were eyewitness accounts. And as I said, there are pictures of a plane in the vicinity.
John, and I got to get out. John, yeah. Farmer, author of Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. I do thank you for your time tonight, John. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You bet.